Hey everybody, welcome back to the Percy Jackson of Poseidon podcast. This is going to be my part 3 review for the Battle of the Labyrinth. So, going into this book, I barely remembered anything other than there was a labyrinth and we meet Daedalus, and that was basically it. I forgot that Tyson and Nico were in this book, so it was fun to see them return and get more of a character arc from them. And we do get a good amount of time spent at Camp Half-Blood in the beginning and at the end, so I do like that. We do get Chiron in a bit more of a mentor role for Percy, which is kind of what I had expected him to be and remembered him to be, but wasn't really the case in the last couple books, so it's nice to see a little bit more from Chiron. And I love giving Annabeth her own quest. I do like the return of Rachel Elizabeth Dare, because I didn't remember if we ever had ever seen her again. So it's nice to see her, and it's fun to bring her back in and her role that she plays in this book. You know, this book, it follows a very similar format to, you know, the other books in the series, right? You know, it's, you know, we start off at camp, we get the prophecy, we start the quest, you know, the group goes off on the quest, we, you know, go to all these several locations, fight various Greek monsters. You know, Percy gets the dreams, visions, and, you know, we resolve the battle at the end, right? And so it's all very kind of formulaic with what the other books have done, but what's different in this, I think, is that we use the labyrinth as a way to travel across the U.S., and that's kind of a fun sort of way, because we don't really know where we're going to end up, right? It's not like a linear path from New York to California. We, you know, pop up here and there everywhere. And so that's kind of fun, nice little surprise. And then we also separate the group, right? We get Grover and Tyson go off to do their thing, and then we bring in Rachel to help. And so that's kind of a fun little mix-up, and then we get the twist reveal that Quintus is Daedalus. And so, you know, it follows the formula of the other books, but also kind of mixes things up a bit and keeps us surprised as we're going along on this quest journey. So that, I think that's a lot of fun. And even though I didn't remember the book well, I do like, you know, what we got from this and where we kind of end up with it. And then, of course, we also get to meet some new gods. We get Hera and Hephaestus, as well as Pan, right? And Hephaestus has been mentioned ever since the first book, so it's nice that we finally meet him. We also get more expansion on Greek myths, right? We get to meet Calypso. We get a reference to Hercules, you know, the labor of cleaning out the stables. And then we get Daedalus, you know, in the legend of Icarus and King Minos and the labyrinth. So I do like building upon the Greek mythological world a bit more. I thought that was good. It's good fun. It's something we do a little bit in each book, and this was something new that we got, which is also fun. And we don't get too many new characters in this book. We meet Grover's girlfriend Juniper, but she really doesn't do much. She warns Percy and Annabeth a little bit, and that's about it. And we meet Ethan Nakamura, but again, he's not in it much, although he does play a part in the prophecy, being the traitor. But it's also nice to see returning characters like Clarice. We get to see her, and we've learned what she was up to off-screen in the last book of, you know, going into the labyrinth and everything. And then we get her, and we see, you know, this nice little subtle relationship that she has with Chris Rodriguez, who we had met in a previous book as well, briefly. You know, and it gives us a little bit more of her character, a little more insight, and, you know, just a, you know, a bit more of character background and story for her. We see a little bit more of a gentler side to Clarice, which is nice. And then we meet Quintus, who turns out to be Daedalus. And, you know, that's an interesting character. I like setting him up as this kind of, like, double agent for Luke, but then it's really Daedalus. And, you know, it's an interesting twist because, you know, throughout the whole book, Annabeth has been admiring Daedalus as a hero. And then we kind of find out, like, all the bad things, like, he did, like, it, you know, through Percy's dreams and stuff. But in the end, he gives Annabeth his laptop of invention ideas and everything. He sacrifices himself. So I do like what we get with Quintus Daedalus. And, you know, similarly, you know, Tyson meets his hero, Briarez, you know, and at first Tyson is let down by Briarez, that Briarez doesn't want to help them, but then, you know, in the end, Briarus does come through and helps fight in the end. And, you know, Tyson kind of reminds him of you know, who he is, and then the hero he can be and the role he can play. And so I like that, and it's a great moment for Tyson, and we get a little bit more character development from Tyson in this book. You know, he doesn't come off as childish as he did in the previous books, and you know, he actually proves to be quite competent at times too. And then, of course, you know, we have a little bit of character development and growth with him and Grover end up working together. And so I do like Grover's arc in this as well. You know, it's something that we set up in the first book, and it, you know, he was off, you know, getting his searcher's license and trying to find Pan. And so we kind of pay off Grover's whole mission in this when we finally meet Pan, and that he is the one that finds Pan, and he's the one that needs to spread the message of Pan. And, you know, this is very fitting for Grover. It's a good resolve, you know, to his mission in these books. And, you know, and it's also kind of cute that he does have a girlfriend. So good for Grover. This is a good book for Grover. And even though it is Annabeth's quest, it's still Percy's story. So sometimes it feels like, you know, it's Annabeth's quest. She should be a little more center stage, a little more taking control. But she's really not, because it is Percy's story. We need him to be our main character and do a lot of things. But I do like what we get with Annabeth in here. We do get a lot of jealous Annabeth against, you know, she's jealous of Rachel, you know, clearly. And Percy's, you know, this clueless teenage boy, and he's like no idea what to do about these two girls that like him. You know, he might not even know how he feels about them. But I do think it's kind of cute, and it's kind of realistic about how, like, young teenagers and, you know, interact, and just them, you know, exploring, you know, and discovering their feelings and not really knowing what to do. And so it's really cute. And so I do wish we got a little more character development from Annabeth. You know, Percy does try to talk to her about Luke. But I do feel like we still need to explain more about why Annabeth is not willing to give up on Luke. You know, I feel like, you know, they tell us why, but I feel like we never really got to see Luke and Annabeth being these great friends that she keeps saying they were, and how much he cared for her. And, you know, this is a case where we need to show, not tell, you know, in order for me to really be invested in this idea that Annabeth wants to redeem Luke. You know, if we had maybe some flashbacks, a bit more flashbacks to them, maybe we had spent some more time with them in the first book before the quest, I think that would have really kind of helped to explain why she's not willing to give up on Luke. So that is a little bit of a flaw for me. But again, these are books written for, you know, middle grade, so they don't get too in-depth with the characters and everything. But I do think it would help both Annabeth and Luke as a villain as well. But speaking of Luke, I do think this is probably his best appearance. He finally feels like he is a villain and a threat. And because, you know, and he literally embodies Kronos at this point. You know, so I do like that, you know, we've taken Luke to a point of kind of no return in, you know, embodying Kronos. But, you know, because up until now, I just feel like he hasn't been used as a really good villain. He's kind of just like side villain character, or it kind of pops up, you know, and does things to prepare for Kronos' rise. But he's never really like super antagonistic, you know, but I feel like this book does a really good job at kind of bringing him up to that level where he's really taking charge more of the Kronos' army. So I do like what we get of Luke in here. I like following up with Nico D'Angelo and his character arc that we get. You know, it's nice to see him, you know, and he finally, you know, overcomes, you know, the grief of his sister dying and, you know, no longer blames Percy and wants to help and everything. So I do like what we get with Nico. I think it's, you know, we get to see him use his powers a lot more, and that's really cool. You know, being the son of Hades, you know, he can talk to the dead, he can raise the dead. He also has these, like, ground powers where he can, like, open the ground and raise the ground and stuff. So it's really cool seeing Nico. And even though he's still really young, Percy keeps mentioning that, like, he seems like he's gotten older. And you can kind of feel that in this book. He definitely feels like he's at a different place, even though he's still only like 12 or 13. So I do like what we get with Nico. And in the end, Nico, you know, proclaims himself to be the Ghost King instead of King Minos, who was like kind of controlling him the whole time. you know, and he learns to accept his sister's death and forgives Percy. So it's nice to see him taking more of an active role in his life, you know, and in the battle, upcoming battle against Kronos. We don't really get a character arc for Percy in this, but he does get some good moments. I think this book is more about Percy transitioning from that kid we met in the first book to a young man that needs to make big decisions about, you know, what's to come in the upcoming war against Kronos, as well as, you know, figuring out his feelings about girls and teenage life and stuff. So there's not, like, one particular story arc for Percy in this, but I think this book does a good job of kind of maturing him up. You know, a good example is when Percy lands on Calypso's island, and he's tempted to stay there, you know, as all, you know, a child probably would be tempted, or a young man with a beautiful lady would be tempted to stay there and, you know, never grow up. You know, she offers him, oh, you'll never grow up, and if he never grows up, then that means the prophecy's not about him, right? So it is very tempting for him, but he does make the choice to go back and help his friends and face the prophecy. And so it's a good way to show how Percy has been maturing throughout these books. And I also like the return of Rachel. I think she's a fun character, and she's a nice foil for Annabeth. I like that. And it's just interesting to see a mortal, you know, human being brought into this Greek mythological world that's come to life, right? You know, and her perspective on how everything's playing out. And so I like getting more of Rachel. I like her dynamic with Percy, and I like, you know, we learn a little bit more about her towards the end, that she's, you know, the daughter, this rich daughter of a real estate tycoon, and sort of her guilt over that a little bit. So I hope we get to see a little bit more from Rachel going forward as well. And also, I like the story of Daedalus. You know, we get these flashback dreams of Percy, you know, and, you know, we get, you know, the classic story of, you know, Icarus and everything, and, you know, the reveal of Daedalus. It was Quintus all along, was nice. And I like that Daedalus is, you know, a complicated person, right? Like, you know, he is this genius inventor that, you know, a lot of people like Annabeth, you know, look up to. But then he was imprisoned, and then he escaped with his son, and then he lost his son. And then he kills his nephew because he didn't want, you know, his nephew to be greater than him. And, you know, and then he takes part in, you know, the killing of King Minos. You know, and he learns to cheat death by putting his soul into these new automaton bodies and everything. And then he was gonna side with, you know, Luke and Kronos. You know, but in the end, you know, Annabeth's, you know, admiration. And I think her overall kind of disappointment in that he wasn't the hero she thought he was kind of affected him as well. You know, it enables him to, you know, come back in the end and do the right thing and make the right choice. And, you know, it's a great way to show that, you know, sometimes people do wrong things, make bad decisions, they do terrible things, even. But that doesn't mean that they can't change and they can't make it right in the end, right? Daedalus, you know, decides, you know, he should no longer be cheating death. It's his time to go. And he needs to, you know, essentially kind of pay. You know, he knows what he's getting himself into in the end. You know, so I do like what we get with Daedalus in this. And I think it's maybe a way to set up a possible redemption arc for Luke, maybe, and that Luke has done all these bad things like Daedalus, but maybe he can still change. I'm not really sure. I don't really remember where we go with Luke, but that could be kind of like a thing that they were trying to do, a parallel. So, also one kind of disappointing thing about the book, though, is that we never actually run into the Minotaur in the Labyrinth. You know, we're in the Labyrinth this whole time. We even meet King Minos' ghost. Yeah, we don't ever actually run into the Minotaur. I mean, I guess we did get a Minotaur in the first book a little bit, but it would have been cool if, like, they, you know, had come in contact with the Minotaur. That would have been cool. And then I also like the ending of the book with Poseidon showing up to Percy's 15th birthday party and, you know, calling him his favorite son, you know, after, you know, reassuring Percy that, you know, Antaeus, who was claiming to be Poseidon's favorite son, is not actually his favorite son. And Poseidon didn't actually agree with what Antaeus was doing, but that Percy is his favorite son. And it shows kind of a confidence that he has in Percy, like Percy is. And he does talk about Percy, you know, overusing his power from within when he blew up the volcano and everything. And so it's kind of nice to see Poseidon taking a little bit more of an active role in Percy's life. I do wish that maybe we would have gotten some more interaction between Sally and Poseidon. Because I want their story. Like how did they meet? And when did Sally learn he was a Greek god? You know, like, there's just a lot of questions there. And there could have been some fun, kind of like, maybe, like, Sally might have been blushing, and they might have been flirting, and Paul Blofus might have been uncomfortable. Like, there could have been some fun, like, character interactions with that. So I wish we would have got a little bit more of Poseidon and Sally, but I still like that, you know, it's a sweet ending to the book. Percy has this nice, normal family birthday party, and it's something he's deserved. And so I like the way the book ends. And, you know, as far as the overall story of, you know, going through the quest and the Minotaur, not the Minotaur, but the Labyrinth and everything, I think it was nice to give Annabeth a quest, but I'm not sure why it had to be Annabeth's quest, if that makes sense, I guess. They do mention that, you know, she needs to make this big decision upcoming, but she didn't do that in this book, you know, so I'm not 100% sure why it had to be Annabeth's quest to go through the Labyrinth. I guess because she's the one that, you know, admires Daedalus, has studied the Labyrinth and everything, you know, and it was nice to give her own quest, but I'm not really sure that the story had to be Annabeth's quest, I guess. So, you know, because again, I don't think we did enough with her character in this. But I do like, you know, kind of seeing, you know, Annabeth gets to use her, you know, actually she doesn't really get to use her wisdom a whole lot in this book, which again, maybe is why I feel like her character isn't as well developed in this book, I think, as much as I wanted her to be, given that it is her mission. But, you know, we do get some cool stuff with Percy. I love him, you know, figuring out how to clean out the stables with his, you know, his power and everything. That was kind of fun. You know, meeting, you know, all these cool different Greek monsters. The battle at Alcatraz, that was a fun setting as well. You know, Briares and the Impusai and all these Telekines and everything. All the monster stuff is a lot of fun. The battle at the end, which kind of was what the, you know, the Battle of the Labyrinth, you know, it's what the whole book has been setting up to. I think the battle at the end was a little too quick. We could have drawn it out a little bit longer and made it a little bit more personal, right? Because it's Camp Half-Blood they're attacking. But I think it works fine in the end. So, and I think, I guess the best story arc in this is Grover's, I think. So, that's good. And yeah, incorporating Rachel into it, I thought was a really great idea as well. So, there's a lot of good stuff in this book. I didn't really remember it very well. And I think that there's a lot of fun to be had in here. There's some, you know, the group splits up a few times, but I do like, and I guess they never really, you know, Annabeth insists on having four people in the group party, and, you know, Chiron says that, you know, that's not a good idea, don't do that. And I don't know if we ever get a consequence for her kind of breaking the rule of taking only three, but instead she took four. I'm not sure what that had to do with anything. So maybe it pays off, I don't remember. But if it doesn't, then I don't know why we even set that up. And maybe it should have paid off in this one, I don't know. So, and but then we almost had a fifth member anyway with Nico. So it's kind of like, well, you know, what are these rules? Why are they arbitrary? And, you know, we don't really explore it too well. But it's okay. So overall, I think this book does a great job of following up, you know, the Percy Jackson series formula while adding some new surprises and twists along the way. You know, I like meeting the new gods. I like meeting the minor Greek mythological characters like Calypso and everything. That's a lot of fun. You know, we got to meet Hera, and, you know, I'm not sure if that will come back in the end of, you know, they kind of, you know, upset her at the end of the book, and I'm not sure how that will play in, or why she even wants to help, why she was even trying to help in the first place. So, you know, it was kind of, so it was a good night, nice to meet, you know, all these new, you know, Greek god and mythological characters and everything. You know, I am curious about what the big decision Annabeth needs to make. I'm assuming it's going to have something to do with Luke. So, I'm not sure. You know, and I'm not sure what role Grover's going to play going forward, given that we wrapped up his character arc. So, you know, we'll have to see. And I do not remember the next book, you know. But I do want to find out what Nico, you know, was telling Percy at the end of the book about what he discovered that will help them in the Battle of Kronos, you know. So I want to follow up on that as well. I don't remember anything from the last book. I think there's a battle in New York, and that's it. That's all I remember. So everything is going to be new to me. It's going to feel new and surprising and fresh. And so I'm really curious to see how the series is going to wrap up going into the next book. But so that's it. So that's my thoughts on Percy Jackson and the Olympians, The Battle of the Labyrinth, the fourth book. I think it's really good. It was a huge surprise for me. Totally didn't remember Rachel being there, but I'm glad she was. And I don't know how I'd rank this book so far, because, you know, I remembered the first book pretty well. I had thought I remembered the second book pretty well, and I didn't remember Titan's Curse and this book at all, and yet they've surprised me. And so, you know, going into these reviews, I would have said my favorite book was The Sea of Monsters, followed by the first book. But now, I think The Sea of Monsters is actually my weakest book. And I would say Titan's Curse is probably my favorite of the books so far. Maybe followed by the first book, I don't know. The first book, I think, is a little bit more of a tighter story, and everything is just new and fresh. But we'll have to see what the next book brings and how I like it or not before I give my final rankings of the books as a whole. So, those are my thoughts. Let me know what you guys think of The Battle of the Labyrinth in the comments below. Do you like it? Do you love it? Do you think it's very weak? What are the things you like about it? Do you like the characters, the character arcs, the storyline, the labyrinth? So let me know what you guys think in the comments. Thank you all for listening to the Percy Jack Son of Poseidon podcast. Bye.